And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where we are about 48 hours away from episode one of The Last Dance, aka the only, not even sporting event, the only, well, it is an event, the only event actually happening. And I could not think of anyone better to sort of preview this with than the Hall of Famer, the great Jackie McMullen, who was around covering Michael Jordan's prime and has an essay, reflection, reported story today on Michael on ESPN.com. Jackie, how are you?
Thanks for having me, Zach. I'm doing quite well, all things considered, right?
All things considered, yes, we're doing all right. So it's here. The Jordan documentary is here. Are you excited?
I am so excited because for me, some of it will be reliving, and then some of it, I'm sure, will be things that I didn't know. I've seen some of it, not all of it just yet. I hopefully will be up to speed soon, but it's really well done. And they got all the right people to talk about Michael. And I love reliving extraordinary careers. And there was none more extraordinary that I've ever covered than Michael Jordan.
Yeah, I've spent the last 4 days just on a 90s Bulls YouTube rabbit hole trying to crunch times of some of these big pivotal games that we're going to talk about. And it's just, that's my childhood. I mean, I'm a teenager coming of age as a sports fan. Those and the 80s Celtics are the moments that made me love basketball. Sure. And Jordan was more, partly because I was older, but Jordan was more, he was just not human. Exactly. And more fascinating in that way than even Bird, who was a competitive psychopath, as you know. But Michael was just, it was just different. It felt different watching him.
Well, because Michael could fly. I mean, he really could. He could hang in the air forever. I was, you know, there when he hit that shot over Craig Elo in the playoffs, the best of five series. And he hit the shot and they just hung in the air for what seemed like hours. Bird was the guy that you would see at the dump, right? He's the guy that was doing his recycling, same as you, with a truck with leaves in the back so he didn't have to rake. Just put him in the back and drive around town. That was Bird. Jordan was always different than everybody. Even when he was young, I mean, one of the great gifts that I didn't realize at the time, because you're just going through it, I was a very young journalist. I literally grew up with Michael Jordan in this business. So I'm in 1986, I'm 25. And literally growing up, watching this guy play and seeing him before all the crowds and the entourages and before you just couldn't get near him. You couldn't be anywhere around him. I remember talking to him in the Bulls practice facility in Deerfield, Illinois. It was like in a strip mall. And no, it was. They practiced and then there was like a little weight area. And I remember once I was going to cover the Celtics. It felt like the Celtics and the Bulls were always playing each other very early on in Jordan's career. And he was lifting weights. And I remember standing talking to him while he's using a Nautilus machine, Zach. That's how long ago it was. My goodness.
That's like we've used Nautilus machines. That's like, you know, that's a normal person thing,
right,
that Michael was using.
Exactly.
So we're just going to do greatest hits. Let's talk about the Elo game, because you mentioned the Elo game in your essay that's up today on ESPN at the Richfield Coliseum.
Right.
You were there. I watched the last 5 minutes of that game today in preparation for this. And I had forgotten poor Craig Elo, who actually is he's a great sport about this, because he's done interviews where he says he's proud to be part of Michael's legacy. He doesn't mind seeing the highlight of himself crumbling to the floor in agony.
Right.
I had forgotten it was like the game of Craig Elo's life.
Oh, he was unbelievable. He should have had the game winning shot. That's the thing. And you know, the other thing people forget about, because all we see is the shot and the win. Look at the defense. He played great defense on Michael Jordan on that final shot. And Michael has slayed so many people's dreams, but none more than the Cleveland Cavaliers and Craig Elo. I was fortunate enough to see Craig earlier this year at a Hall of Fame event in LA. And he's such a delightful person, still is, by the way. Very gracious, as you mentioned. But I stood with him, Zach, for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And everybody that came up to him mentioned that. Can you imagine going through the rest of your life having people? And he didn't do anything wrong. I'm not saying that, but I mean, how about just how are your kids? You know, just to mix it up.
I watched an interview with him. Mike Greenberg had a great interview with him on the 30th anniversary of the shot last year. And he said he lives in Spokane, Washington now. And
right.
He said, yeah, you know, I go down the street in Spokane, Washington and it's the only thing anybody ever wants to talk to me about is the shot. Now, you look at Michael's lines from that series, it's just straight comedy. Here are the last three games of that Cleveland series. 44-10-7, 54-3, 44-9-6 in the last game. I mean, it's just like and it wasn't just the shot. Like he makes a jumper. I'm going to check my notes here. He makes a jumper with 6 seconds left to put them up by one. And then Elo, as you mentioned, has this great give and go layup that just, it leaves too much time on the clock. And then Michael hits the shot. So he hits two essentially game winning jumpers
right.
in 6 seconds. And as you mentioned, the fist pump, the like extended arm out sideways fist pump, every kid my age tried to imitate that. That was the coolest celebration in the history of sports.
Tell the truth. Did you use a trampoline? Because you needed one. That's the only way you did, no. Right?
I'm glad there's no footage of me trying to imitate it because in my head, as I'm doing it, I'm like, yeah, I'm nailing it. I got the fist pump. And then you actually see it like, oh, I'm about 3 inches off the ground and like my arm is flailing like ugly at my side. You know, that was the cool. So what do you remember of that game? Did you write off that game?
Oh, I did. But you know, so you're a detail guy. I'm an emotion person. That's what separates the two of us. We both do our jobs differently. What I remember so, so vividly. Now, just for context, the Richfield Coliseum was in the middle of nowhere. It's not where Quicken Loans Arena was in downtown Cleveland. It was in the middle of nowhere. And that place was rocking. Because again, for those of you who are too young to remember that Cleveland Cavaliers team, this was their time, Zach. This was their time. You're talking about Brad Daugherty, a frontline big man. You're talking about Elo, who wasn't the star of that team. Mark Price and Brad Daugherty were the stars of that team. And they were supposed to be around for a really, really long time.
They were the team of the 90s.
They were.
They talk about how they were given the moniker team of the 90s. And Michael Jordan just came. I was like, yeah, nothing.
Yeah, no, sorry, guys. I'm a little busy right now. And the thing, again, to put into context for people, Michael Jordan hasn't won anything yet. He hasn't been in the league very long. He hasn't won a thing. And there, again, people forget this. When he was early in his career, in 1989 still, people were saying, well, he's a great talent, but he doesn't win. He doesn't make the guys around him better, that whole refrain. And here's Michael Jordan winning the biggest game up to that point of his NBA career, certainly not his career, but because he won for Carolina, but his NBA career. And it turned the Cavaliers into a footnote in the NBA trajectory.
And almost literally, they're like a parenthetical, like, oh, by the way, there was this other team that was pretty cute and good.
And as we go through this conversation, Zach, you'll see a pattern emerging. He did that to many other teams. And it's astonishing. He did it to the Indiana Pacers in 98, crushing. He did it to a New York Knicks team in 93 that was favored over them. Pat Riley, bully ball, you know, Anthony Mason. I'm jumping ahead, but my point is this.
That's okay.
What I remember, you asked me what I remember. What I remember most of all, because I had gotten to see a lot of Jordan already, because we had already had the God Disguised as Michael Jordan game in 1986 at the Boston Garden. So I had already seen some amazing things from this kid. But he hits that shot and it's like a balloon gets popped, except for you don't even hear the pop. All you hear is the nothing. Absolutely nothing. Because he crushed everybody's dreams in that arena. I don't even remember a groan. I just remember an absolute stunned silence. How did this just happen? And who just did this to us? That's what I remember. Now, leading up to that game, as I referenced in my column, I remember talking to Jordan, you know, after game four, we were talking about the Cavs. He was nervous. Don't think that Michael Jordan wasn't ever nervous. All the great ones are. Now, once the game starts, those nerves disappear immediately. But in the days leading up to it, talk to all the greats, Jerry West, Russell, Bird, Magic, all of them will tell you nerves are normal, and managing those nerves and transforming them into positive energy separates the greatest players from the, you know, average players. And I remember talking to Jordan, his knee jangling at the locker room. He's talking, he's back and forth between like positive self-talk and a little bit of just nerves. And, you know, then we started talking about the team he was playing and I don't remember talking about Craig Elo. I don't think any of us were thinking of Craig Elo. And I said to him in sort of in passing, you know, well, they're a bunch of good guys. And he looked at me and he said, maybe too nice. And it didn't occur to me too much later.
That's almost like a cartoonishly good Michael Jordan.
Yeah, but it's
like sneering, like maybe too nice, don't you think? Maybe too
right,
nice.
But he said things like this all the time. The beauty of Michael Jordan was there was no filter and it was a different world. There wasn't social media. There wasn't 24/7 people chasing him around till later, till the second incarnation of Michael Jordan. In this younger time, you could get time alone with him. And he would say whatever he thought and felt. And if you didn't like it, and by the way, I'm not just talking about to the media. I'm talking about to his teammates, to his coaches.
More to his teammates. He was, people think of, younger fans know his ruthlessness, I think, from what he did to Kwame Brown right. When he was like, you know, the elder statesman. He was ruthless when he was younger. And if he didn't think you were good enough, he would be, get this guy out of here. And what you and I talked about before the podcast, when they traded Oakley, who was his best friend, for Cartwright, he hated Cartwright. He would throw the ball hard at Cartwright in practice, like whip it at him like a 90-mile-an-hour fastball just to have Cartwright drop the ball and be like, well, this guy has bad hands. He grew to love Cartwright, of course. Cartwright grew into an emotional touchstone yes. on those teams, but he was mean. Uncle was mean.
All the great ones are. All the great ones are, or most yeah. of the great ones are, I think. And then, but Michael, the way he went about it was he was so driven to be the best, and it sounds so cliche, but it really was true. And I'm talking about the best that day in practice, the best at knowing the state capitals. I referenced that in my story. I didn't know this till again later. You get context later after guys retire and people talk a little more freely. He would do this. He would ambush his teammates. What's the capital of Mississippi? What, you know, this was something that Michael liked to do, and he expected you to know the answer. And I remember, you know, I always equate him to Bird in this regard because they were both, I thought, really ruthless competitors. I would throw Kobe into that mix as well. And I think not every elite Hall of Fame player is like that. Those three guys in particular were to me. And Jordan didn't care what he had to do to get his teammates motivated. And I always go back to Bird when he called his teammates a bunch of sissies after a particularly bad loss to the Lakers in the NBA Finals. And I think it's why the two of them, Jordan and Bird, admired each other so greatly, because I think they looked and saw a lot of themselves in each other. Now, not as a player, because they played completely differently, but just in terms of the way they approached winning.
The interesting thing about the Elo game, yes. the shot game, I don't want to call it the Elo game, it's just the shot game, poor right. Craig Elo, is that it's a reminder that Michael was not infallible. Like in the last 3 minutes of that game, he missed a free throw and he had an air ball in like the last minute of the game on a floater. And it wasn't that we built him up into this. It's like he never missed a big shot in his career. And he would tell you he missed plenty of big shots. But the two things that are impressive when you watch these games, and by the way, I've watched most of the big pivotal Chicago playoff games now in the last week. He missed big shots in all of them. But the two things that, and I'm talking in the last 2 minutes, I'm talking free throws, there's things that have been written out at the historical record. But the impressive thing is, number one, he always came right back. It never affected him. And number two, like mentally, just come right, give it to me again. And number two, his hit rate, even with the misses, was still incredible, because it's, even if it's a 50% hit rate in the last 2 minutes of close games, for most star players, those are 25 to 30% shots. And his hit rate, even with the misses and even with the occasional air ball or missed free throw, his hit rate is still incredible, but he was not infallible. And in fact, what made him so great was that when he did miss a free throw, when he did air ball a floater, he didn't moan to the refs. He didn't let it get to him. He said, just give it to me next time. Just give it to me next time. And I'm going
to
make it.
He might have moaned to the refs once in a while.
Once in a while.
Right. But I think the other thing about him, Zach, that we always forget about is he, for every game he dominated offensively, he dominated it defensively as well. And I will use, and we are skipping ahead, but the shot over Brian Russell, everyone remembers that. What they don't remember is how he did it, because he stole the ball and came down with 10 seconds left and then shot it over Russell.
That's an all time sequence. The strip and the shot. In my mind's eye, I'm seeing Karl Malone on the left block and Michael coming to double team him. Yeah. Karl doesn't see him and he slaps like a dramatic slap of the ball.
And that's the part about Jordan that I just so appreciated and really loved. was the way he played defense. And partly because Dennis Johnson, God rest his soul, you know, in that famous 86 game, DJ was an all defensive player and could not stop Jordan, couldn't stop him, and talked about it, you know, at length, was gracious enough to do that, but told me later on, he said, just watch what he's doing on the defensive end. Stop looking at how many points he scores. DJ was the first one that alerted me. I was a young writer at that time. And he said to me, watch how he hedges on plays. Watch how when he knows what guys are going to do before they even know they're going to do it. And we always talk about offensive players with great instincts throwing a pass to a space because they know the player is going to be there. I had never really thought of defensive sequences in that way until DJ alerted me to that. And then, boy, then you really start keening on the kind of stuff, the way Jordan gambled, the way he cheated, the way he would double and then hedge back. And I mean, just incredible.
Well, he and Pippen together is the greatest combination of wing defenders ever. I don't think it will ever be topped. And in fact, I was watching game four of the 93 finals against the Suns and Charles Barkley. Another year of like the Michael Jordan MVP revenge tour. If someone else got MVP in any year, forget about it. Michael is going to eviscerate you in the playoffs. And that's the game. The Bulls win that game at home to go up 3-1. And once they're up 3-1, I understand Phoenix forced a game six. There was like some minor suspension. Once the Bulls are up 3-1, they are not going to lose three games in a row.
Right.
The series is over. That's the end. And Scotty has a sequence in the last 35 seconds where Barkley gets a steal and Phoenix has a 2-on-1. In fact, he steals a pass from Pippen and Marley is going to tie the game with 30 seconds left and potentially tie the series. You give Phoenix a chance to tie the series. And Marley goes up for a layup and recovering, strips him. And then Phoenix gets the ball out of bounds. Ainge comes off a Barkley screen and Horace Grant and Scotty switch. So Horace Grant is on Ainge and Scotty's on Barkley on the block. Scotty's in trouble. Right. Barkley is peak Barkley. He's going to mow Scotty over. Ainge entry pass to Barkley. Scotty skirts around Barkley, deflects the ball out of bounds. Phoenix gets the ball back, but in 10 seconds, Scottie Pippen by himself erased two advantage situations for Phoenix in which they could have tied the game, and then Jordan ends up winning the game, which we'll get to. Let's talk about your story because that's the concrete hook. You start your story today not on a basketball court, but on a baseball field. Tell the listeners about going to Birmingham when he's on the Birmingham Barons playing baseball. Why did you start the story there, and why was that visit so memorable?
Well, first of all, I have no idea, looking back, how I ever convinced – I worked at the Boston Globe then. How did I ever convince them to send me there? I don't know. But I'm very happy because it was during the NBA playoffs. So how I ever convinced them to let me do that, I don't know. But I really wanted to see Jordan. I think I kind of missed him, honestly. I wanted to – yeah, and I wanted to see for myself what was going on down there. So I went down. I called ahead. I never talked to Jordan. I think I just hoped that I would get there and maybe he'd give me some time. So I'm waiting for him. You know, they're in uniform. It's a game day because every day in baseball is a game day. So it's not like you can go on an off day. There are none. So I was there and I'd gotten there the night before. I was standing on the edge of the dugout and I see him. And by the way, as spectacular as he always looked in a baseball uniform, he looks every bit the part in a baseball uniform. Let me tell you. He looks like a guy that could hit home runs and steal 40 bases. I mean, really, honestly. So I see him, and more importantly, he sees me, and he comes like bombing over to me. And I thought, wow, he looks happy to see me. Now, just for context, 2 days before, I think, maybe three, but I think it was 2 days before that, the Bulls are playing the Knicks, and Phil Jackson draws up the final play for Tony Kukoc instead of Scottie Pippen, which – to this day, I would love to really know what that was all about. Next time I see Phil, I'll ask him again, and maybe he'll actually answer. And of course, as the famous story goes, Pippen is so upset and shocked and angry, he won't go into the game. He refuses to go into the game.
He was going to be the inbounds passer. They wanted to use Scotty as the inbounds passer.
And so Scotty's mad, doesn't go in the game. Kukoc, of course, hits the game winner, which is why this story is so spectacular. But you know, all hell breaks loose. And here's Kukoc, who probably hit the biggest shot of his Bulls career. And all anybody's talking about is why Scottie Pippen wouldn't go into the game. So that's as Jordan's bounding towards me, that's the backdrop. And he doesn't even say hi to me. Like, hey, how are you? He just says, can you believe that? That's what I don't miss, the infighting, whatever. And I was like, wow. It was just such a moment. And I thought, this is incredible. Now, later on, when I wrote the story, I think in the story, I looked back on it because it was quite a while ago. He actually says in the story, for public consumption, Please don't ask me to comment on Scottie Pippen. That just wouldn't be fair. I'm not there anymore. That wouldn't be fair. So he didn't comment publicly that time. But of course, that's a moment I never, ever forgot. And I spent, I don't know, 3 days down in Birmingham watching him work his tail off. Zach, he could not hit a curveball. The game I was there, he struck out 4 times in 1 game. And by the way, his manager was Terry Francona, who later became the manager of the Boston Red Sox.
I forgot that.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And let me tell you a quick aside on Francona, because I got to know Terry very, very well, of course, because he was the manager in Boston, won some World Series here. And years later, when I did a story on him, and it really wasn't about Jordan, but of course I had to ask, and he told me a great anecdote about Jordan when Jordan first got there. You know, he was decent in the field, but having trouble hitting. And so one of the pitchers jammed him, and he popped the ball up. There were a couple of men on base, jammed the ball, popped it up, and he's mad. You know, he throws the bat down. He just stands there disgusted looking at this pop-up. He's really ticked off. So they go back into the clubhouse, and Francona goes up to him and goes, hey, so I just want to know, like, are you going to do that every time? So, like, you're not going to run those out. Like, every time, is that what's going to happen? And so Jordan says to him, it'll never happen again. And it never did.
Wow.
Isn't that a great story?
So Michael tells you, you go down to Birmingham, and very naturally, one of the conversations you want to have is, what are you doing here? Like, why are you not playing back?
Right.
Like, you're astonished that the Boston Globe sent you to Birmingham. I'm not. It's Michael Jordan playing baseball during the NBA playoffs.
And he tells you, you write
today that you were skeptical at the time that he was really done with the NBA, which I'm dying to hear why you were, but he gives you this quote and he says, people got bored with my skills and what I accomplished was no longer viewed as excellent. And I read that and I said, that's a load of crap. Like, I don't know. I don't even know what he's talking about, because nobody was bored of watching Michael Jordan. Everybody was in awe of Michael Jordan. And if anything, maybe it was reaching the point where people would start rooting against him, because it's so fun when right. Goliath, the guy who's impossible to beat, actually loses. But that quote shocked me, because I just don't remember this idea that people were taking Michael Jordan for granted has just never made any sense to me.
Well, so again, let's think about the context of it. By this point, his father has passed away, and almost immediately, and I don't know how many people remember this, but almost immediately when his father passed, his father was murdered, people started drawing correlations between that and Jordan's well-known gambling issues, and suggesting that the gamblers were repaying a debt by murdering his father. And of course, that was totally unfounded. There was no basis in fact to that whatsoever. But the very idea that anybody would do that, and his father has just died. You know, this is happening within an hour of his father's death. I didn't use this in the column that I wrote for ESPN, but I quoted him somewhat extensively in the original article talking about this. It bothered him deeply, Zach. So I think it was more the idea of why, you know, so you can't find anything wrong with my basketball. So now you're going to go start poking into my personal life. Now you're going to bring my dead father into this. It was just so upsetting to him. And he was, I think he just thought, you know what? I don't need this. I am the greatest that ever played. I don't need any of you voyeuristic people poking into my life, trying to poke holes in my legacy. I don't need it. I don't want it. I'm tired of it. I think there was a real fatigue about being the great Michael Jordan. Well, That's my own impression.
If he had said, this was going to be my follow-up, if he had said, yeah, my father was murdered, died tragically, I just needed to get away. I needed to do something different. It affected me deeply, and this was somehow my coping mechanism. That would make sense to me. That would make perfect sense. No one ever took his greatness for granted. And, you know, again, if you want to know, no one's really answered the question of why did he quit basketball in a way that is satisfying to anyone. And that's why all these conspiracy theories still burble up about, oh, did David Stern suspend him, this and that, which is, you know, whatever.
Right.
And maybe he just had an emotional, this was his emotional coping mechanism. That would make sense to me.
It would. Well, and let's take that a step further. When again, in this story that I wrote, but he's talked about to many, many people, his love of baseball began with his father, playing catch with his father in the backyard, his father going to his games. He talks about in the documentary about his parents. There was a, you know, a large family that wanted to keep everybody busy. So they got him involved in sports. They signed him up for baseball. So I think there was a real connection between his father and him that had to do with baseball. And I think he always, his father probably said to him, like our parents do. I mean, my parents used to say to me, oh, wow, I wonder if you hadn't chosen basketball. I wonder if you had pursued track and field. You know, I was a long jumper and a sprinter. You know, wow, I wonder what would have happened. And, you know, and parents say that, right? Because it's something they enjoyed watching you do. And so if you lost one of those parents and those memories come back to you, maybe you think, you know what? I'm going to do this. I need some time away from all the noise and all the infighting, to his point, you know, and cause let's be real about this. The first three championships and the last three, in both cases, there was jealousy. There was egos involved. There was money involved. It was not an easy thing. And we've heard this from all the dynasties. We've heard most recently the Golden State Warriors, how difficult it is to keep a great team together with large egos and ownership that they own the team and they sometimes feel like they own you. We know that Jerry Krause was a very controversial general manager who Michael Jordan did not like, did not respect, did not get along with.
Kicked him off the bus once or twice.
Absolutely. You know, nicknamed him Crumbs. They all used to call him Crumbs because he'd eat his muffin on the bus and have crumbs all over his outfit. So all of these things, plus the immeasurable grief of losing your parent in such a horrific public way, maybe it all makes sense.
Why did you leave Birmingham skeptical or that he was really done with the NBA or with some belief that he was going to come back?
Right. Well, the first thing was because of the way he came charging towards me. It was the first time that I can remember he was really excited to see me because I was a connection to his old life, to basketball. But, there were some other things again that he said in that article that I wrote. I mean, however many years ago that was now, I don't know, a long time ago. And one of them was, you know, I said, do you ever think about it? Do you watch the games? He says, no, I don't have time. And I didn't believe that. First of all, I didn't believe that because he knew what happened with Scotty and Kukoc. I'm guessing he watched the game. That was the first thing. But the other thing was he said something to the effect of, I don't have anything left to prove to like the Barclays and guys like that, but it would be fun. I wish I could remember who they were. He said, you know, to some of the young guys to see what they're made of. And I forget who they were, but they turned out to be not quite as memorable as perhaps Michael Jordan thought they were going to be, you know, some up and coming rookies. And so he was already talking about, no, I don't care about those guys. I own those guys. But it would be fun to own all these new guys that are coming in and think that they think that I, you know, I could never measure up to them. So I just left there thinking, if you're the greatest at what you do and you're in the prime of your career and you can't hit a curveball, this thing's going to end. And what are you going to do next? He could not hit a curveball, man. It was awful.
I mean, curveball, they're apparently very hard to hit. I don't think.
I'm not saying there's
a whole side plot of Major League about how what's his name couldn't hit a curveball.
Right.
You mentioned, let's go through some specific games. You mentioned the sure. God disguised as Michael Jordan game, which is in the first round of the 1986 right. playoffs, arguably the greatest team in the history of the NBA, in the history of basketball, the number one seed against the lowly scrapping right. into the playoffs. That's the year I believe that right. Jordan barely played because he had a broken foot.
Broken foot. Yeah, missed most of the year. And they had a minutes restriction all year
which
long.
Which he was chafing at, which he was angry about because he wanted to play, so wanted upset. To play. He's right. a maniac, all yeah. this. And he comes in and drops 63 against Boston in game one. It was game one, right, of 86.
No, game two. He actually scored, and I don't have it written down, but I think he scored like in the 40s, let's say. I wish I had it in front of me, and I apologize. I told you I'm not the best detail person. I'm more of a memory yeah. of the moment person. But he had a big game in game one, and DJ was just like flummoxed because he was such a good defender. And he's like, well, we're going to have to do something different. And then DJ said, well, the good news is he scored like 45 or whatever and whatever it was. And I'm embarrassed that I don't remember. And he said, well, the good news is, you know, it was a lot. And he goes, well, the good news is they didn't win. And I mean, he's not going to do that again. No, he's not. He's going to score 63.
So I was 8 years old.
Okay. So you're forgiven for not remembering.
No, but I was 8 years old. And in my memory, the idea that a human being could score 63 points in a playoff game
right?
as an 8-year-old, I was like, this is a space alien. Like, this is not a real thing. It's not possible. I can't, against the Celtics, this guy scored 63 points. Now they lost, but still, it just seemed the number six in front of a scoring total just seemed fake. It seemed pretend. So I don't, you were at that game. You're a young reporter. What are your memories of it?
Well, so I was actually in the stands because back then, I was a young reporter at the Globe and I didn't make the A team for this particular game. So I didn't get to cover it, but I got tickets. My husband, my boyfriend at the time, we watched the game and it was the most incredible thing because they could not stop him. Everybody tried. They had DJ on him. They tried Ainge on him. Bird was even on him for a couple of possessions.
Yeah, it didn't go well for Larry. There are some bad highlights of Larry trying to go.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't go well for anybody, including DJ, which was the stunning part. But the funny thing about the Garden crowd was he had just scored a ton of points and lost. So no one was actually even paying attention to the fact that the game was really close. Everybody was just enjoying the show.
It went to overtime, did it not?
It did. It went to overtime. And then they won in overtime. But the funny thing about it to me is that there was a real appreciation from the Garden crowd for this young guy who was doing this to their team, to your point, that may have, I think, I'm biased perhaps, the best front line in basketball history, number one, and lost one game, exactly one game all year, a home game against the Portland Trailblazers that still bothers Larry to this day, still rankles him to this day. So no one was actually thinking, well, wait, maybe they're going to win the game until the, you know, the final few minutes because he was impossible to stop.
No, that
the Celtics were such a better team.
That was the series when the playoff brackets come out where you just immediately look to the next round. Like you don't even consider this a series worth your attention. And all of a sudden this guy is dropping 63 and Larry gives one of the all time great quotes in the history of sports saying that's God disguised.
Right. Best of five. Don't forget now. Yeah. Best of five. So weird things can happen. And you know, that Cavs Bulls series that we referenced before, that was a best of five.
Yeah.
So that game winning shot was game five. I loved best of five in the first round because it could really turn things on their side a little bit.
Well, if we get any NBA playoffs this year, we may get a whole lot of funky stuff.
Best of three. How about best of three? Wouldn't that be something?
Best of three reaches the point where it's going to be really fun, but it's no longer NBA playoff basketball. And so people reckoning if there's a monster first round upset in a best of three series, I think people will reckon with it differently.
It'll be tainted. Yeah,
the upset, not even tainted, but like say the Bucks lose in the first round. I think that series is forgiven. Maybe not more than
it is.
Maybe Giannis will forgive it. I don't know, but who knows? Yeah. We're now off on a tangent. Yes. Let's go through some other Michael games that you were at.
Okay. Sure.
His first finals, 1991 against the Lakers. Sort of the Lakers' last gasp at a title team. Chicago loses game one, and it's a shocker. They lose at home. Sam Perkins hits a three. Sam Perkins playing small ball five. Bill Cartwright had no idea what to do. Just left him wide open to double Magic, who had Michael on him. And then Michael misses a pristine jumper.
Very good luck.
To win the game that rattles in and out. And then that finals then proceeds to be kind of a squash for the Bulls, and it has the spectacular move by Jordan.
Right.
Left switch. What are your memories? But it's Magic and Michael, right? I mean, it's still special because it's Magic and Michael.
Well, and it's more special for Jordan than it is for Magic because one thing you have to remember about Michael Jordan, and that is he has an incredibly long memory. Don't ever forget that. He does not forgive, nor does he forget. And he, to this day, no matter what Magic will say, what Isaiah Thomas will say, and they both say it never happened, the freeze out in the famous All-Star game, it doesn't matter anymore whether it's true or not because Michael Jordan was convinced it was true. And that's all that mattered. And so Michael Jordan has this mental checklist of things that he needed to take care of. And one of them was, I'm going to check Magic Johnson off my list. And I think, you know, we can argue whether that really happened in this particular series, because to your point, they were sort of on their last gasp. And remember, too, Worthy and Byron Scott didn't even play in game five. They were both injured. So they were a depleted Lakers team on top of everything else. So you don't put asterisks next to those championships, but it's just a fact. And, you know, Jordan did hit a huge shot. I think it was game three. He hit a pull-up jump shot to win. But the shot that he missed in game one, I remember I did a story last year, Zach, on pressure, great players and how they process pressure. And so I got called Jordan and asked him if he would participate, which he did. He was fantastic talking about it. And he said, you know, people say, well, pressure, you know, if you miss a shot, then the pressure builds for the next one. He said, I never saw it that way. And he referenced this shot that you're referring to in game one against the Lakers. He said, look, if you want to go back, that's the biggest shot. That's the biggest miss of my career. We're in the finals for the first time and I miss it in game one, a game we're supposed to win. Well, what am I going to do? Like, go home and curl up in a ball and cry about it? No. He said, I went back and looked at it. It felt good. It left my hand clean. I did everything right. I just missed it. Sometimes we miss. And again, that's what the greatest players, not the great players, the elite players, that's how they approach it. You can't let a miss muddle up your brain.
It's amazing. First three-peat Jordan was, I mean, this is an obvious statement, but you was such an otherworldly athlete.
He was.
That it was ridiculous. So you look at shots like that, you put whoever the best defender is on the other team is going to guard Jordan in that situation.
Right.
One hard dribble toward the rim, stop on a dime, jump. And he's
separation.
Wide open. He's
separation.
Wide. He's got nothing but clear sky in front of him because the best defenders in the world are biting so hard on that dribble because they're so scared of his drive. They can't stop like he can and they can't jump like he can. And it's just, it's pristine. And it's shocking that he misses that one because it's just, it's Michael Jordan. You think it's going to go in.
It's got to go in. Even then, remember now, this is again, 91, where the narrative is still, yeah, okay, let's see this guy win something. Well, he took care of that in the series, you know. In fact, the thing that I thought was, and again, this is hindsight. I wish I was smart enough to really realize it when I was watching it, was this. It was the first team since 1978 that had won a championship with the center averaging less than 10 points a game. Cause Bill Carter averaged like, I don't know, 9 points a game for that.
Six of them were in the first 4 minutes of every game and they would
That's
dump
exactly right.
the ball.
That's exactly correct. Get them involved and then get them out of there. But what we didn't, at least I didn't register. And I wish I was astute enough to have done this was this was the beginning of what we call small ball. This team dominated with two wing players. Forget Golden State and all those others. This was the team that won championships, dominated games without a big man's presence.
Or a big man score. I mean, they did have Grant and Cartwright at the four and the five, which is a pretty big front line, but they didn't use them. They didn't use the center was not the hub the way.
Not even close. And so I wish I was astute enough at that time to say, hey guys, we're seeing something a little revolutionary here. It just didn't feel that way because everybody else, you know, like the Pacers that played up against that, they had the Davis brothers and Rick Smits. And then, you know, the Knicks had Ewing and Anthony Mason and all these big players. And, you know, the Portland Trailblazers had Duckworth and Utah Jazz had Mark Eaton. It didn't matter.
I feel that way about the second three-peat team because once they got Rodman and Kukoc, they could do they played Rodman at center a lot where they would play Harper, Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, Kukoc, which is like a really modern NBA lineup, or even Kerr, Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, Kukoc. They could, those 97, those 96 to 98 teams could go really big, really small, or really uniform. Like, don't play Harper or Kerr at all and play Jordan, Pippen, Kukoc, Rodman, and someone else. They were a very flexible, malleable, interesting team actually to watch now in terms of how modern they could be with Dennis at center.
Exactly. And, you know, that's what Phil always says when people start talking about small ball and all that. He'll say, well, what do you think the triangle is in his mind? That's what the triangle can be if you want it. Of course, the triangle can be anything you want it to be because they used the triangle with the big dude named Shaquille O'Neal and were pretty successful with that. But that was the beauty of the triangle was that you could take it and adjust it to your personnel and make it work regardless because it was all about movement, passing the ball, finding the open man, which was usually Jordan.
I don't know what Michael's all-time greatest game is, another game I wanted to ask you about because it has to be in the conversation is the 1993 finals against Phoenix.
Phoenix, which is
93 was such a great playoff season all the way
it
around.
It was,
and everybody wanted to see Barkley versus Michael.
Right.
Chicago wins the first two games in Phoenix. The Suns have home court advantage, and you think it's over. That's it. No, they win the first two games on the road. It's done.
Right.
Phoenix wins game three in Chicago, so the home team has lost every game. Game four, this is the game. This is my favorite game of every playoff series. Game four is either it's going to be a gut punch and it's 3-1 and it's kind of over,
right,
or you got the barn burner best of three coming up. Jordan scores 55 points.
Yep.
On 21 of 37 from the floor, including a ridiculous and one on Barkley with 13 seconds left to ice the game. I don't know what the greatest game is. Maybe the flu game in 97
game and
is 98, the greatest game.
And the 98 game because we all knew it was over. I mean, that was a pretty spectacular performance.
But hanging 55 on the Suns at the absolute apex is like, that may be as pure a distillation of what Michael Jordan was in his prime as any game. So you're there.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember of that game?
Well, I was just amazed at, because we had heard about, Barkley and Jordan were good friends, and we kept hearing that they were playing golf, you know, on the off days. Still not sure if that's true. Barkley denies that. I still think there's a small kernel of truth to them hanging out a little bit together. And in retrospect, people said that Jordan was totally inside Barkley's head and killing him with the kindness for this exact moment that you're describing. For when the game is on the line, I'm going to crush you. You're no different to me than any other guy. You may be my friend, but I'm going to crush you now in this game. And so their relationship, their vibe to me was endlessly interesting during this series. And Barkley struggled at times in this series. You know, in fact, the game before they won, I think it was a triple overtime game. Game three, I think was triple overtime. And yeah.
I'll look it up.
I got it right here. So
it was triple overtime.
Yeah,
it was.
And, you know, Marley hit a big shot for them. Chambers hit some big shots for them. It wasn't always Barkley making the biggest play for that team. Whereas it was always Jordan making the biggest play. Even if he wasn't scoring, he was drawing attention and making the pass, as he did famously to Steve Kerr and as he famously did to John Paxson in other situations. And so to me, it was that 55 was sort of the punctuation mark, if you would, on, okay, let's keep this straight. I'm not done winning. And to your point, the MVP revenge tour. Don't any of you start betting against me because you're going to lose. That's what it felt like to me. That place was going bonkers. The game before, game three, was a little closer, a lot more exciting, you know. But to your point, once he dropped the 55, they're up 3-1, and I'm like, I just want to go home, man. I want to go home. I have a little baby at home. I'm like, come on, man, finish him off in game five so I can go home to my family. And then they didn't.
No, they didn't. 93 and 98, so the third and the sixth title. Mm. Are very similar finals in that the Bulls do not have home court advantage,
right,
and go up 3-1. And so it feels over at 3-1. Like you just can't,
you can't fathom Jordan blowing a three, or Pippen for that matter. I mean, Pippen never gets enough credit. So let's throw Scotty in there too, because he was just remarkable. And I love one thing about Jordan, how he consistently says to this day, none of it happens if Scottie Pippen isn't standing right next to me. And, you know, he's not the kind of magnanimous guy that would say that if he didn't mean it. He means it. He understands exactly what Scottie Pippen did in terms of personality, in terms of giving up shots, notoriety. And let's not forget the fact that Scottie Pippen was like the 140th highest paid player in the NBA during this whole time. So,
well, you mentioned how egos and stuff tear these dynasties apart. Yeah. I actually think the Bulls were an extreme version of that for many reasons, a lot of which was that Scottie was so chronically underpaid the whole time, mm-hmm, and so bitter and so angry about it, and so bitter about Kukoc getting more attention than he was when Kukoc hadn't played an NBA game. So bitter about Horace Grant making more money than he had. And Horace leaves because he's bitter about how the Bulls, the management player relationship and just the contractual realities that the rules were not as sort of rigid as they are in terms of what contracts you can sign, and everyone just gets a max deal. And Scottie had signed this long deal for the sake of security that I think chronically underpaid him. But, yeah, 93 and 98, the Bulls go up 3-1, but don't have home court. And so there's this glimmer of like, once it's forced to six, there's this glimmer of like maybe the other team actually has a chance if they can get game seven at home. But you still
never believed it. And, you know, the thing, too, was the Suns. I don't know if you remember this, but in the first round, they played the Lakers. They went down 2-0 against the Lakers.
Best of five. I mean,
they almost were going to be the biggest choke artists ever. And then they came back and won that series. And, you know, Barkley was fantastic. So I was at that point. By that point, I'm just like, no one's ever beating this guy. There's just no one who's ever going to beat this guy. And you know, Zach, I could tell you the truth. I never stopped feeling that way, ever, until he, you know, went to Washington, obviously. But there was never a game that I covered in the postseason when I saw him play that I ever thought anybody else was ever going to beat him. I mean, that's how dominant he was. And again, I stress, because it was, because he could do it on both ends of the floor. And as he became older and more mature, he understood that it may require a pass instead of the final shot to get it done. And he was good with that. He was good with that.
The other thing about that Phoenix game, and you see it in young Jordan more than old right. Jordan, is, and you see it in the Cleveland game, the Elo game too, the degree to which these teams are just throwing two guys at him at once he crosses half court is ridiculous.
But they can't stop him anyway. They still can't.
So that shot, the and one he hits over Barkley to ice game four of the 93 finals, starts with him getting double teamed by Ainge and Kevin Johnson, kicking the ball to BJ Armstrong. And BJ's like, no, cool. You can have it back. Just gives it right back to Michael, who has two guys on him. He dribbles away from the double team. Barkley meets him in the lane, and you can tell Barkley is halfway between, should I challenge the shot? Should I try to draw a charge, or should I just tackle him and make him earn it at the line? And he goes for kind of, should I draw a charge? And he's moving, and Michael hits this and one over him. And so he beats three guys. He beats three guys in the span of 2 seconds. There's just nothing anybody can do about
it. That was, you know, and that's why I think the later championships to me were in many ways more remarkable. In fact, I have an assignment that I have to finish soon for our ESPN.com on ranking the one through six, the best championship, best team, or the most satisfying championship or whatever. And that's why for me, 98 will always remain number one, because of how hard it was and what was riding on it. We all knew. I mean, Phil Jackson wrote on the playbook that he gave all of them at the start of the season, The Last Dance. That's where the name for the documentary comes from. So they all knew this was it. And remember, in that season, Scottie Pippen asked to be traded. First of all, he had surgery beginning of the season, because he was frustrated about getting paid or not getting paid. They wouldn't redo his contract. So he thought, well, the heck with it, then I'm going to have this surgery now. I'm going to get healthy, and then I'll be ready for my new team next year when I get healthy. And then ask for a trade. I mean, the stuff that went on that year was incredible. And Jordan is no longer playing exclusively above the rim, because he probably could, but he was smart enough to understand, you know, he'd become a very good shooter at that point. You know, he's a career, I don't have in front of me, it's a low percentage, 33% three-point shooter at 34. But again, the game was, people need to understand, the game was different then. If the three-point shot was emphasized the way it is now, I don't have any doubt that Michael Jordan could shoot 38, 40%. There's no doubt in my mind. It just wasn't how the game was played then. It was not emphasized enough. Therefore, you weren't putting in the reps either in games or in practice. But he was no longer exclusively above the rim. So that's why I always put a little more weight into those later championships, especially 98, because it was a very, very good Utah Jazz team they beat. And then before that, as you know, because we've talked about it off the pod, one of the most incredible series, probably the toughest series, would be interesting to ask Jordan, but the 7-game series with the Indiana Pacers in the Eastern Conference Finals. You know, you could argue the Pacers should have won that series.
Yeah, I talked with Mike Breen the other day about what you just talked about just the air of invincibility and how it just felt that some way, somehow, his teams were always going to win. As a fan, you had to trick yourself into believing that the other team really could win to have some defense. But if you wanted to pick like the moments of actual legitimate vulnerability, it's 93, the Knicks are up 2-0 in the conference finals. Now, I did not think the Bulls were vulnerable even then, but if you're down 2-0 and you don't have home court, you're vulnerable. And game five, Game five is the Charles Smith game that comes down to the wire. If that game goes differently, you know, and so it's that, and it's Pacers game seven, 1998 that you're talking about. And it's my favorite of the Bulls finals, just as a fan, my most favorite, the one I was most into was 97 against Utah, which is 2-2, and game five is in Utah, and it's right. The flu game. At 2-2, game four is when Stockton and Malone have the full court pass in the last minute of the game. One of the great passes in NBA history. Malone lays it in. Utah goes up by one, goes on to win. At that moment, you thought, maybe the Jazz can actually do this. And then game five happens, and Michael's sick, and he looks sick. And on TV, you're like, this dude can barely walk. And I just remember thinking, the Jazz are going to go up 3-2. They might actually pull this off. So those are the moments of vulnerability. 97, 93, and Pacers game. I don't pick whatever one. Those were the ones where the invincibility was like, maybe.
Well,
maybe,
and what I think those teams had in common, and I go back to the Pacers team of 98 and to the Knicks team, they were big. They played bully ball, Zach. They were strong. They were physical. And, you know, the Pacers were down 2-0 in that series to the Bulls in 98 in the conference finals. And they were getting manhandled. Phil Jackson did a really smart thing. He put Scottie Pippen on Mark Jackson. So Mark Jackson, mm-hmm. you know, made his living posting up smaller guards. And now all of a sudden couldn't do that. And he put, I think it was Ron Harper on Reggie Miller. So he made some really good adjustments. So the first two games, the Pacers, you're thinking, they got no chance. They got no chance in this series. They can't keep up with these guys. But what they started doing was just saying, let's pound them. This is where we have an advantage. We have a size and a physicality advantage. Let's use it. And that's how they got themselves back into that series, you know? And they just got really, really physical. And, of course, game four, that's the famous shot that we see all the time of Reggie pushing off Michael and hitting the game winner. And Phil's yelling, you know, calls. We never get any calls, which to me was just beyond hilarious because Michael.
And that's Larry just standing
nothing
there.
Nothing ever happened.
If,
yep.
You know, just literally he's watching a train go by or something on a peaceful Sunday afternoon.
But that was all by design. I have asked him about that a bunch of times. And he said to me, I just thought I cannot show how excited I am because I know it's not over and I don't want them to get giddy. We haven't done anything yet. That was very much by design. And, Brad Stevens, if you notice, he's a little more emotional now. He's getting more comfortable in the NBA. But when he first came into the league, he would be very deadpan. If they won a game at the buzzer, they'd show Brad no expression. And I asked him about it once, and he said, when I was a kid growing up in Indiana, I watched Larry Bird. And I saw that, and I thought, okay, that's how we have to do this. Isn't that interesting?
It's funny. Yeah, that is it is funny how different coaches react to, but Larry was ridiculous. That was ridiculous. That he just stood there like you're a statue.
And you realize like Larry Bird, he said, I will only coach 3 years and then actually was a man of his word, only coached 3 years. I just think he could have been a Hall of Fame coach. I really do. So he always talks about game seven of that series in 98. And before the game, Michael guarantees a win. Shocking. Michael Jordan, of course, is he's unbelievable. But this is the play that Larry Bird always talks about. They're up three with about 6 minutes left. The Pacers are. Do you know what
having watched the game the other day, I have a guess of what I think it's going to be, but
I'm
not sure.
So Derek McKee knocks the ball loose. There's a dive. They're diving on the floor. There's a jump ball. Is this what you think?
My guess is right. I know what happened.
So they're having a jump ball, and it's Rick Smits and Michael Jordan. Okay. Now, of course, as great as Jordan is, it's probably not going to win this tip. Rick Smits is 7 feet tall. So they're lining up for the jump. And, you know, Bird and Dick Carter, his right-hand man, his assistant coach, are standing there. And they watch everybody line up. And Pippen's kind of hedging a little bit in on Reggie Miller, who's in front, right? He's in front. And it's clear sailing for Smits to tip behind him. It would be an easy tip. Now, remember, the Pacers are up three here. So they're looking at it, and Bird says to himself, oh, this is perfect. He'll just tip it back. And then he's like, oh, shoot. He never tips it back. He always tips it forward. Now, this is all in a matter of milliseconds, right? So Harder says to him, maybe we should call timeout. And Bird's thinking, no, we're going to win the tip. I want to save the timeout. But as he's thinking this, he's like, but I've never seen Smits tip it back. He's going to tip it forward. They're going to intercept it. I'm going to call timeout. And it's too late. The ball's up in the air. And Pippen does exactly what Bird fears. He jumps in front of Reggie, you know, Smits tips it to Reggie Miller. Pippen jumps the passing lane, steals the ball, gets it to Michael Jordan, who, by the way, misses, because you were talking about he doesn't make every shot, missed that shot. But Pippen got the rebound because, of course, they killed him on the offensive glass. It was like, yeah, like
that's
23.
How they, that's how they won the game on offensive. Michael Jordan in that game has four baskets that are off, yeah, that are putbacks. And I think three of them are putbacks of his own shots, including a free throw miss that he rebounds and puts back in.
But anyway, so he misses a shot. Pippen gets the rebound, kicks it out to Kerr. He hits a three. So instead of the Pacers winning the tip, having a chance to be up five, now it's a tie game. And if you ask Bird about that game, if you ever get the chance, ask about that jump ball, because that's what he remembers all these years later still.
So I watched it the other day, and it looks like you're watching all these games on low definition, and it's like you can't even, like, low definition feels like what were we all doing? Like, this, I can't even watch. Oh, I can't even see what the hell the players are. It looks a little bit like Jordan jumps, and his arm kind of hits Smits's arm.
Oh, okay.
It's hard to tell because it's like something from the 20s. But it looks like his arm kind of hits Smits's arm and interferes with Smits's ability to completely control the tip. Like, Smits wins the tip,
but he can't quite direct it where he wants it to go. Zach, if he just goes backwards, they're all set.
Right.
That was Bird's point, you know?
Steve Kerr is coming on the podcast next week to talk about Jordan and The Last Dance. And I texted him while I was watching the game. I said, Steve, this jump ball. Yeah. You know, you get this offensive rebound, you hit a three. I just said, Steve, I just watched you tie game seven with a three and this crazy jump ball. And he said, Reggie Miller and I to this day talk about that play all the time, about how that was the play that swung the game or changed the game. I don't know what he said, but he said, Reggie and I talk about that play every time we see
each other. That's the one that sticks in Bird's craw, that and, of course, the rebounding. I think they also missed a ton of free throws, didn't they? I think they missed like 14 free throws,
Well, a lot of them are Dale Davis, which is like you can't really be mad at Dale Davis missing free
Chris
throws because that's what he does. Before I let you go, I mean, we're talking about games, but what are some other personal Michael Jordan memories that you can share that are important to you? I mean, even in your piece, you talk about how you see him today and you see, you know, a father who likes to go skiing with his kids, and that detail seems to stick with you for some reason. So maybe there's something. An interview you did with him that meant something in your career.
Well,
maybe, I don't know. What else comes to mind?
I had called him about a story I was doing. I think it was Kobe. I was doing a story on Kobe's retirement and all the great mentors he had. And, of course, Jordan was number one. I wasn't sure if Jordan – you never know if he's going to call you. You know, you talk to Esty, his great assistant, who I adore. I do have Jordan's number, but I very, very rarely ever text him because I shouldn't have his number then if I'm going to do that, right? So I think the only time I've ever texted him, frankly, was the day Kobe died. I texted him, and that's when he told me, I can't even – no words right now. I can't even – but anyway, so I'm at home. My husband was away on a ski trip, actually, and the phone rang, and it was a Florida number. And I'm like, oh, it's probably either a radio show that I don't feel like doing right now or spam. But I don't know. Something made me pick it up. It was him. And I had called him for this story for Kobe, and he was fantastic. And the thing that really resonated with me was, you know, Kobe just wanted to be like Jordan. That's really all he wanted to be. He just wanted to be Jordan. And Jordan really had a soft spot for Kobe. I heard it. This is not after the fact now that Kobe's gone. This is Kobe was alive and well. He was about to retire. And the kindness with which Michael talked about Kobe that night to me, some of it off the record, some of it on. So I won't share the off the record stuff because that wouldn't be fair. But real concern that Kobe, because he fell short, he didn't win the six championships like Jordan did. And because people were always comparing him to Jordan and talking about how Kobe fell short, that really bothered Jordan because he really had great respect for Kobe going about things the right way in terms of preparation, in terms of that killer instinct that we've talked about a bunch on this podcast. So there was a real kindness about Jordan when he spoke of Kobe that a reflective kindness that I don't think I had always heard before when he was in the throes of competition. And we had a kind of a long conversation that night. I had actually ended up in the, now I'm telling something I didn't think I'd be telling. I ended up in the emergency room that day. I had had like a heart palpitation, which I had never had before. And I've never had since, not sure why I had it. And so he said, well, what are you doing? I said, oh, I got my slippers on. My husband's away on a guy's ski trick and I'm drinking a glass of wine. And I said, maybe I shouldn't have. I just had this thing today. I went to the, I don't know why I even told him. And he was like, hey, now, at our age, like, you don't mess with that. Like, that's, you know, you got to make sure you follow up with it. And it was funny, like, because we're close in age, you know. I'm older, but we're similar in age. And it just sort of occurred to me when I was speaking with him that day, that evening, which was a while ago now, whatever Kobe's final year playing was, that, I don't know, we've been through a lot together. That's what it kind of felt like to me. And it was a very nice feeling to have. He was not in my market. You know, he was not in Boston. It wasn't like my experiences with Bird and Parrish, McHale and Danny and all of them. But it meant something to me. And it was great to have a conversation with him that had nothing to do with me trying to find out something that was relevant to his career or his legacy. It was just two people having a conversation. And those are the things I think that all of us that do this business, when you have those moments, you cherish them.
What you're really describing is you got a much more personal and private and early sneak peek at his speech at Kobe's memorial.
Which surprised
so many people because it's just the side of him that no one really had ever seen before. And in fact, the contrast with his Hall of Fame speech, which is sort of classic, ultra competitive psycho right. Jordan, that speech at Kobe's thing just blew everybody away. And you got well in it 4 or 5 years in advance, a sort of a private and personal and much longer and in-depth kind of version of that personal to you. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, he is a ruthless competitor and all that, but he's grown and evolved many times through the years. And the person he is now, remarried with two daughters that he likes to take skiing, that's a kinder, gentle Michael Jordan. You know why? Because he doesn't have to prove anything to his kids. He doesn't have to be the best skier in the world. He's just enjoying the fruits of a very long labor that ended with him, in my mind, it's being the greatest of all time.
Yeah, you watch, you know, the greatest of all time conversation is something for a different day. But statistically, LeBron is gonna blow him away, but LeBron's gonna pass him in sort of raw statistics. He's not gonna catch him in championships, barring something really unexpected. It just you watch those. It's just not fair because you watch those old games and you remember how it felt that he was unbeatable. He was unbeatable right. in a way that LeBron has never. And it's not LeBron's fault. Maybe his teams weren't as good. He didn't have right. a Pippen until he had Wade, and Wade kind of fell off pretty early. But he's moved around a lot and all this.
Right. But here's the thing I'd say about that, Zach. Here's the reason why. And I think, look, LeBron James is one of the greatest players of all time. The second greatest player of all time in my mind. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's no crime in that. But here's the thing about Jordan. He never, ever, ever took a day off. He just didn't. And I think there were moments where LeBron was frustrated last year with the LA Lakers, where that just, you can't say that about him. Now, in fairness, Jordan was on championship teams, right? He always played with a great cast. Certainly LeBron didn't last year. And who knows what Jordan in his prime would have been like if he was on a team like the Lakers were last year. I don't have the answer to that. So that's why maybe that's an unfair thing. But the two things that always separated Jordan from me were that he very rarely ever took that. And he hit some of the most iconic shots in history at the most pivotal moments. I think it's 25 gamers. Now, I know there's different metrics for that. I think there in some yeah. metrics, LeBron has more with this much time left or that time. I'm not saying that LeBron isn't.
LeBron's made a lot of big shots.
He's made a lot of big shots.
He's underappreciated in that sense.
He is, but
made a lot of big shots.
But they're just not quite as dramatic, right, as Jordan over Russell for your last dance. And I mean, you know, there's just a flair for the dramatic. Well, I guess they both had that. I don't know.
Well, I think someone counted them up once Lillard had his second playoff walk-off shot. There's only like 6 or 7 or something in NBA history. And obviously the Elo shot is one of them. Mm-hmm. Dame has two. Ralph Sampson has one.
Right.
There are maybe one or two others that I'm forgetting. But, you know, to your point, I mean, that's why the shot is the shot. That's why
right.
it's capital T. Capital S, the shot.
Right.
Anyway, Jackie, you have an essay up today on ESPN.com. I think we're going to be seeing a good degree of you during the run of The Last Dance, which is anytime we see a good degree of Jackie McMullen, that's always good.
Thank you, Zach.
You're a Hall of Famer. You know everything in and out. It's always a pleasure. I just love talking to you, and I consider this podcast just sort of like if I went and got a beer with you, we'd talk about this, but there's now listeners to it. So thank you as always for your time. Stay safe, stay healthy, and hopefully I'll see you soon.
Let's do it again sometime, Adam.